Okay, once again, I was asked earlier on, just before the meditation, to give a talk on a particular subject. They reminded me I'd promised to give this talk some time ago, and that if I don't give this talk, I'll be in big trouble, because they wanted for me to talk on a little article they gave me of a book which a nurse had written, who was looking at deathbed regrets. All these people she had nursed, and talking to them in the last few moments, and just some of the regrets which they've had in their life, and talking about these so that people realise what's important in life. And I told the person who asked me to give a talk on this, if I don't talk on this evening, that'll be one of my deathbed regrets. And I never gave this talk, so I have to. And it's not going to be a morbid subject, simply because when we look at what people regret, you know, when they're just about to die, then it's something which we can do to make sure that we don't fall into the same problems. And it's a way where we can really understand what we call the meaning of life. And some years ago, I gave a talk in Singapore. The question at the end of the talk was, please tell us, now, how can we die well? And my answer was, by living well. If you live well, then you will die well. And so how do we live well? This is actually what you learn when people, at the end of their life, they say, well, you know, I should have done this, and I should have done that, and I didn't do that. And that teaches us what we should be doing while we still have the time and energy to do it. And I remember one of the regrets, which was one of the most common, was, I wish I hadn't have worked so hard. And that's a really important thing in our modern world. We work so hard, and what it means is that we don't have enough time for play and enjoyment in our life. And to me, that's such an important thing, to have play. Even though that we think we're only supposed to do that when we're at school, and that when we mature, we're supposed to grow out of that playfulness. But those of you who know me and know the monks at my monastery are always messing around. You know, we're all just, you know, you might say that monks are kids who haven't grown up. But actually, it's a bit more than that. But we still just allow that beautiful playfulness, which is one of the energizing parts of our life and energizing parts of your life as well. So please don't be so serious, especially that's one of the things which turned me off religion when I was young. Religion are all so serious, and you never ever found anybody cracking a joke sort of, you know, in the church. And that was actually, it's just a great revelation, you know, when you came across people, you know, like the monks in Thailand, and they would crack jokes and they would make you laugh and think, my goodness, these are very tough monks, but they are human and they are warm and they are joyful. Because for me anyway, that any sort of religion is supposed to, you know, answer the problems in life. And I wanted to find out that the people who supposedly knew the meaning of life, that they were happy as a result. I wanted to see the end product. And so it was really wonderful actually to see just people can be so light-hearted no matter what was happening in their life. For example, you know, talking about death, my mother passed away just two or three weeks ago, so I'm just going on Tuesday, to, as Dennis was saying, for the funeral service. And I've been telling people she hasn't died, she's escaped from the nursing home. That's how I put it. And that's my mother. I respect and love her a lot. But that's how I put it, she's escaped from the nursing home. And when you're playful, you can see things in a different way. That's even when I was doing science at Cambridge. The people always say, when you've got an experiment, play with it, just like a little kid, because then you can see new things. You can experiment and find out new ways of looking at things, new ways of doing things. It's in that playfulness where you become innovative. And in that innovation, you're actually living your life and really enjoying it and finding new ways of looking and new ways of doing things. That's why playfulness is really important. So one of the regrets that please, please don't live your life and at the end of your life think, I didn't play around enough. I don't mean playing around with other people's wives or husbands or things like that. That's not what I mean by being playful. I mean, which reminds me of just this one story of, you know, deathbed regrets. Here it comes. This is this evening's joke about this man. He was on his deathbed. And by his deathbed was his wife and his four sons. And three of the sons, you know, were 6'2", you know, really sort of strong, athletic, you know, all got university degrees. And the fourth son, he really stood out because he was small, squat, and never even finished high school. And the husband looked at his wife and said, "Darling, I'm about to die soon. Please be honest. Tell me the truth. I won't criticize you, not at this point. That fourth son, you know, the short, squat, ugly one, was he mine?" And his wife looked at him and said, "I swear on my mother's grave, that was your son." And he said, "Oh, thank you so much." And he died happily. And after he passed away, she turned around and said to herself, "I'm glad he never asked about the other three." So you see, I monk can be playful. Which is one of the reasons. That's the only joke today, so if you want to go now because you've just been hanging out for the joke. That's it. But some of the regrets which we're going to have, you know, like the first one about like working hard or working too hard. Because sometimes you ask yourself, you know, what is the meaning of our life? Now, are we really working too hard? What are we working hard for anyway? You know, just to be able to sort of get the money to pay the bills. Yeah, it's important to get the money to pay the bills and also to pay your subscriptions to the Buddhist Society as well. But, you know, there's much more to life than that. And sometimes at the end of the life, we look back and see, just, you know, did I really enjoy my life? Which is very important why that, you know, in our community, yeah, we do work hard, but we do have holidays. It's supposed to be a long weekend this weekend. So what are you doing on this weekend? Is it just going to be more work? Are you going to have some time enjoying? Have you got all this list of things you have to do and get out of the way and fulfill? So it's really important to find time to rest and relax. And I tell you, that's what I've been doing. You can ask this monk sitting next to me just every Monday when I finish the weekend here on the morning, I just really relax. I don't do things. And I'm a really busy monk. I've got lots of things I should be doing. Just like, you know, the reports for the AGM next week and all that sort of stuff, which I promise I will write out sometime soon. But all these things which you're supposed to be doing, I make sure that I give myself a time for rest. For two reasons. One, because, I mean, that's the most important thing of our life. You know, we do work hard, we do travel so far, but can we not spend a time for enjoying, you know, our moments, our free moments? And there's a saying which you've heard here before, and if there's any saying you really want to write down so you understand the meaning of life, this is one of them. That when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. It's a beautiful little saying. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So on this weekend, yes, it's, you know, you may want something more, but it means you can't enjoy the weekend. You can't enjoy the holiday when you want something more. Look, you've worked so hard, you've got enough. You know, you're going to have to work again on Tuesday or whatever. But on the Sunday or the Monday, just relax and enjoy yourself. Otherwise, on your deathbed, you'd regret it. All this time I've worked so hard and I haven't really spent time just being here, relaxing and enjoying my life. And there's so much to enjoy. You've got beautiful houses. It's living in a beautiful state. There's beautiful beaches. There's beautiful forests. There's beautiful monasteries. Why not spend time just doing nothing, relaxing, and enjoying yourself? Because sometimes we spend all our life working. And if you do that, work, 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 you will regret it at the end. Okay, sometimes we say we work really hard and when I retire, you know, then I can sort of relax. But by that time, You can't enjoy your relaxation. You know what it's like. Everything aches. You know, there's a few Thai people here this evening. The word for a man in Thai is poor, and the word for a woman is meh. And they have this saying, the old people, the old man and the old woman, they're called poor oi and meh oi. And the reason they call them poor oi and meh oi is because whenever they get up, they say, oi, oi, oi. And that's true, because that's what happens when you get old. So if you pull off your enjoyment of life and relaxation until you're old, I mean, you can't really enjoy it at that time. And I'm saying this, I know it's bad for the economy, and Wayne Swan will probably think that, you know, I'm not going to support these guys, you're supposed to work harder. But please spend time enjoying yourself. And by enjoying yourself, I don't mean that when you're not working at work, you're working at home. That's what sometimes people do. On the weekend, they've got this whole list of things they're supposed to do. And you do all that stuff, you know, for your whole life. And when you die, you'll regret your life. You never spent time just being peaceful and enjoying. And that's why one of those other sayings, which I like saying here, when you go home this evening and you think, I have to wash all those dishes and clean up the kitchen, please, before you wash those dishes, you must count how many those dishes are dirty and how many clean ones are in the shelves. And if the clean ones outnumber the dirty ones, quit while you're ahead. Now, why are people so obsessed, you know, with cleaning up the kitchen? Is the kitchen there for itself? You know, are you there for the kitchen, or is the kitchen there for you? You know, is the house there for you? Are you there for the house? You know, what's life all about? And when you are reminded and when you get the idea, you will find you can spend far more time doing nothing and just enjoying how far you've come in your life and not carrying on the journey trying to get somewhere until tomorrow. Because for most people, life is a journey where you don't have any rest. There's no pit stops. You're always going on to the next thing. And because you're always going on to the next thing, you don't know how to stop. Sometimes I ask myself, why is that? A lot of times people are afraid of stopping. They're afraid of peace. They're not quite used to doing nothing, which is why it's such a hard thing to do. It's one of the reasons why in Buddhism we teach meditation, which is nothing more than the art of doing nothing. Learning how to enjoy just sitting there and doing absolutely nothing, not getting anywhere, not trying to achieve anything, but just being here for a change. And you'll find in these little moments of meditation, just being here is such a peaceful, wonderful place to be. And that gets rid of the fear, which means that you can spend more time just being here in those many moments of life, like long weekends, like times when you don't have to do anything, to pick up a book or to, you know, see what's on the TV or see what's in the fridge. You can just enjoy yourself doing nothing. You know, as a Buddhist monk, even it's hard for me to do nothing, because every time I told the monks, you know, I'm doing nothing, they say, oh, can you please come and help me then? You know what it's like? If you do that at home, you know, your wife says, what are you doing, husband? Says, oh, I'm doing nothing. Oh, great. Can you please come and, you know, help me shopping or whatever? So I've got another way of saying I'm doing nothing. And I taught this to people. It's watching the trees grow. So down in the monastery over in Serpentine, and when people say, what are you doing? I said, I'm watching the trees grow. You know, trees do grow, you know. But you have to watch them for a long time to see it. And if you just turn and do something and it grows and you miss it. So this weekend, if your husbands have asked for, you know, some help, you say, no, Ajahn Brahm said, I'm just watching the trees grow this weekend. It's an excuse for doing nothing. I know that some people, you know, here in, you know, come to this centre, they think the only way they can really relax, you know, and do nothing and just enjoy the moment instead of working is doing things like going fishing. And many Buddhists have actually asked me, is it all right as a Buddhist to go fishing, especially on these long weekends? I say, yeah, sure, there's no problem at all. You can go fishing. But a Buddhist fisherman never puts a hook on the end of the line. They get the fishing rod and they put it in the river and they just sit there. It's much more peaceful. Because then you go and get disturbed when, you know, the fish goes and bites them. You've got to reel it all in. And that's really disturbing your peace. And also, you don't have to be embarrassed because no one knows. Because, you know, the hook's under the water. They can't see it. The fish knows. And the fish swims past and, oh, that's another Buddhist fisherman. Well done. But you're more peaceful, more happy. So if that's what you want to do for a nice, quiet, you know, few hours, yeah, go fishing. But remember, leave the hooks off. And then it's far more peaceful. Because that's what Buddhists say. I like going fishing because it's peaceful. I say, great, more peaceful, take the hooks off. So sometimes that's just a little excuse for doing nothing. And you'll regret your life if you haven't spent enough time doing nothing in this world. Otherwise, you've been on this journey just like those little hamsters in the wheel, always going round and round and round and round and round and round, never stopping and appreciating how far you've come. You know, it's wonderful when you appreciate how far you've come. It brings you so much joy and so much happiness. Each one of you have achieved a lot in life, and you deserve to enjoy it. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So spend a long time enjoying how much you've achieved, all the hard work. And the only way you can do that is by sitting down, doing nothing, and enjoying all the dishes which have been washed, all the vacuuming which is... Yeah, some more to be done this afternoon, but now I can enjoy all the vacuuming which has been done. All the letters which have been written, all the emails which have been sent, but no more for the next couple of hours. That is the way you can enjoy doing nothing. In my little book, Open the Door of Your Heart, though, I say it's so difficult to do because I use the simile of the garden. So many people in a place like Perth have these wonderful houses with these gorgeous gardens in the back of your house. But how many of you, especially on a weekend like this long weekend, can enjoy your garden? Just sit out there and enjoy it. And how many of you is it a place to work? You work over in the office or in whatever you work, and then on the weekends, the garden is a place of more work. Look, please enjoy the garden. To enjoy the garden, you get a nice seat out there and you sit down. But what does the first person do? The first person says, well, now once I've watered the garden, once I've mowed the lawn, once I've pruned the bushes, once I've got all the jobs out of the way, once my garden is perfect, then I can sit down and enjoy it. And you know what happens? That garden is never perfect enough. It's the nature of things. There's always more things to do in life. There's always another job in the garden. There's always another thing to be cleaned in the house. There's always more things to be done in life. So to think that you've got to get all those little chores out of the way before you can stop and do nothing, you never do nothing at all that way. Please, the only way you can find some peace is in so-called imperfection. Even there are so many jobs to be done, not now. This is a time for rest. Which brings up that other great story. And again, these are stories from that little book, but this is a brilliant story. And it really fits into this part of the talk about learning how to relax and not do so much. This was that monk in Thailand. It was Ajahn Buddhadasa who was building his main hall in his monastery. This big building. And in our tradition, when it comes to our retreat period, which is in the winter time when it rains, usually from July to October, at that time, all the work stops because it's the time the monks and the nuns just meditate and just, we don't go traveling anymore. We really sit down and do a lot of meditation or study or training. It's a time when we really don't do much. And that was the time which was coming. So this monk sent all the builders home and said, come back in 3 months to finish off that hall because now we're all meditating. We want some peace and quiet. So the builders went home A couple of days later, a visitor came, saw that half-finished hall, and told the monk, "So when are you going to finish that hall?" And the monk said, "Sir, it is finished." And the visitor said, "What do you mean? You know, there's no roof on it. There's no glass in the windows. There's pieces of timber and cement bags all over the floor. What do you mean it's finished?" And this monk, with the great wisdom of someone who knows how to relax, said, "Sir, what's done is finished." And then he went off to meditate. Now that is real wisdom, wisdom in life. What's done is finished. Which meant that he could take time off and just enjoy himself. So in life, if you've got a garden, remember what's done is finished. So it is finished. So you can relax. But be careful, because I remember telling that story sitting here maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And on Sunday, I got a complaint by a couple of Sri Lankan parents. They phoned me up because apparently their son went out on Saturday night, and the parents apparently told their son, "Son, you promised that you won't go out until you finished your homework. Have you finished your homework?" And the son said, "Mum, Dad, just like Ajahn Brahm said, what's done is finished. See you tomorrow morning." I really got into trouble for that. But no, good on that kid, because he needs some enjoyment as well. But you need that enjoyment as well. So if you sit out in the garden, you really want to enjoy, so you're not working so much, that's another great thing to say. What's done is finished. So you can give yourself those moments of peace. So look in the garden, yeah, you know, the lawn needs to be mown, and the bushes need to be watered and pruned and stuff like that, but not now. Now you can just leave it alone and enjoy that garden. And the second person, they think, well, okay, I'm not going to do anything, but I'm going to plan. I'm going to plan. Now, where are those bushes are going to go? And maybe, you know, those nice little ornaments you see in the garden shops, maybe I can put one over there. And maybe I can repaint the fence over there. That is not doing nothing. That's doing mental work. The only way you can have peace in a garden, to be able to understand that what's done is finished, is to be able to say, even though the lawn needs mowing, even though the bushes need pruning, even though everything needs watering, even though the leaves need raking, even though the fence needs painting, not now. This is a time to have some peace. You deserve it. And if you do grant yourselves those moments of peace, you'll soon come to the realization that you have been working too hard. You have been running around too much. And you wonder why you didn't take those moments of peace earlier in your life. Because they are really important. That's what the garden is there for. To give that beautiful peace. And a wonderful realization you have is you don't have to have everything perfect to relax and enjoy it. The garden is never perfect, but still you can sit there and relax and enjoy every part of it. As one of the monks in Thailand used to tell me, in any forest you never see the trees all straight and in a line and in rows, except in government plantations. But that is not nature. In nature the trees are all higgledy-piggledy all over the place. That's why nature is beautiful. In the same with your garden. Because there's leaves all over the place, and some of the bushes are a bit dry, and some of the lawn is, you know, and needs mowing. It's beautiful like it is. When you stop and realize what's done is finished, you can appreciate the beauty in what you thought was imperfection. When you stop, you can appreciate things as they are. They don't have to be just so. And the result of that, you can look at the person you live with and realize they don't need to be pruned and watered and painted, that they are also beautiful as they are. And you look at yourself and all the things which you think are wrong with you, all the things which need to be done before you can enjoy yourself and be at peace with yourself. You realize with that, similarly, the garden. You can be at peace with yourself exactly as you are. When you're working so hard, you never get those great insights. They're just like the forest with all the trees leaning over, branches hanging off, brown leaves, yellow leaves. That's a beautiful forest. You look at yourself with all of your idiosyncrasies, all your stupidities, all your bad jokes. That's good enough. You're beautiful as you are. That's what happens when you stop and enjoy the moment. You can not only enjoy the moment, you can enjoy the people you live with, and you can also enjoy yourself. You can enjoy life when you stop and take a look. That's why you realize you've been working too hard, enjoying too little, always trying to change the world and make it better instead of stopping and enjoying it as it is. So when you start giving yourself some time, it means that you can have no regrets. You've enjoyed your life. I don't mean you're going to be absolutely lazy forever. You do work hard, but at least balance your life and give yourself moments and hours and days of peace, for goodness sake. So that's one of the first things to do, so you don't have regrets. One of the other things is obviously to spend time with the people you enjoy and love. Because that's one of the regrets which many people have when they die. They never spent enough time with the people they really care about. You know, your kids, even your partner and your friends. Sometimes lives get so busy, we do so many things, and sometimes it's just a case of reordering our priorities. There's another little simile which I haven't said for a long time, and which is a simile which, again, an MIT professor actually told me that she said it in a business school in MIT. And it was a story of a person who came into the lecture theatre and just took out a jar and put the jar on the table and, without saying a word, put some rocks in the jar until they could get no more rocks in the jar. And then the professor said to the students, "Is the jar full?" And they noticed, "Yeah, it's full." She smiled and got out some pebbles, smaller rocks, which she could work into the spaces between the rocks. And then when she got no more small pebbles into the jar, she asked again, "Well, is the jar full?" And being intelligent students, they said, "No, probably not, you get something more in." She got out some sand, very, very tiny rocks, and put the sand in the top of the jar, shook the jar, and much of that sand found its way into the spaces between the rocks and the pebbles. And when she got no more sand in the jar, she asked once more, "Is the jar full?" And they all nodded their head. She got the water jug and poured water into the jar until you get no more water in. And then she said to the class, "What's the meaning of this simile? What am I trying to prove to you?" And apparently when I first heard this, one of the students put their hand up and said, "Sir, or madam, it teaches us that no matter how busy we are, we can always fit something more in." He said, "No, that's not the meaning. It's the opposite. The opposite is, if you want to put the big rocks in, you have to put them in first. The most important things in your life, you have to schedule them in as a priority. Otherwise, you'll never get the big rocks, the precious stones, into your life." So once you realize what we mean by precious stones, you realize it's the people you live with, your partner, your kids, your parents. They're so important. Put them into your schedule first. Otherwise, you'll never fit them in. If you understand what I mean, you understand it's just a matter of prioritizing. And if you give priority to what's really important into your life, you'll find your relationships, your family thrives because they're really important to you. And then you can find time to them. You get them into your schedule first. The other things, like the shopping and the painting and the gardening, and you can fit them in afterwards. The pebbles and the sand and the water, they can fit in afterwards. But prioritize what's really necessary for you. Put that in first, and other things can fit around that. Unfortunately, we don't do that in our life, which means that our relationships, which form the heart of, you know, the meaning of our life, sometimes get neglected. We don't spend time with it because we're busy, we'll do it tomorrow. Look, now is the most important time. Now is the only time you have. So your relationships, your family, friends, please do it now. Otherwise, you will regret it when you die. One of the other regrets, I'm not sure if this was actually in there, but I remember that this was from my life, that sometimes that we regret saying sorry. You know what it's like? Sometimes you've done something wrong. You've made a mistake. And sometimes that opportunity when you can tell someone, look, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Sometimes it passes. And the longer it passes, the harder it is to say sorry. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I told you that this week I'm going to my mother's funeral. I remember my father's funeral service, and this was a long time ago, before I became a monk, about 45 years ago now, when my father died. At his funeral, there was regret there. And my regret was I never really expressed how much I cared and loved for my father. I never actually told him how much I loved him. And it was also something which was eating me. And that was, I was a young 16-year-old, and I was like competing with my father, like two males in the same house. And the way I would compete was that I loved Jimi Hendrix. My father loved Frank Sinatra. And sometimes he put his Frank Sinatra on, and I put Jimi Hendrix on. You all know who's louder. I always won. And it's only a silly thing, a stupid thing like that. You may not think that's very much, but I remember at his funeral feeling so guilty. So bad that, you know, I stopped my father enjoying his music just because I was a young, stupid 16-year-old, you know, trying to compete with my father. And I remember at the time thinking, I wish I'd have said sorry. I was only just playing around being a stupid 16-year-old. I realised at least that much. But I know afterwards, even though it was a regret when he died, I know afterwards that I decided, you know, when I became a monk, that it was never too late to say sorry, even when someone has died. Because I remember just in a monastery in the north of Thailand, just thinking and visualising my father, just visualising him inside, and say, Dad, for all those times, all those times I drowned out your Frank Sinatra with my Jimi Hendrix, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, a small thing, but you know, it's those small things which really eat at you inside. And so I made my peace with my father at that time. I said sorry. And the most important thing is you say sorry inside. Whether they hear it or not is not that important. That you say sorry, that is what's really important. And to make sure that doesn't happen again, for those of you who have seen me do funeral services, I always include a forgiveness ceremony in the service. For those of you who've seen me do funeral services, you know, part of that service, you ask everybody, now please, can you imagine the person who's passed away? There's usually a picture there. Look at them. And I do this little forgiveness ceremony. So anything that person has done or said, intentional or unintentional, on purpose or just by accident, which may have hurt you or irritated you, or things which they didn't do, which they should have done, on their behalf, I ask your forgiveness. Please forgive them. And now, each one who's listening, if you have done or said or even thought anything which has irritated a person in the box, or things you didn't do which you should have done, say sorry right now. It's a wonderful ceremony. Because what it does, it releases all that ache, that pain inside, those thoughts of not being good or perfect enough to someone who you love a lot. It's a release. It's obviously better to do that earlier on, you know, before that time happens. But at least I know, because people have a hard time of saying sorry, that's one of the reasons why I do it at that funeral service. So before you go, that's even better. One of the biggest regrets is we never said sorry. And it's such a beautiful thing that you say sorry to someone And they accept it so much. And if it's done in a proper way, they don't say, yes, it's about time you said sorry. I've been waiting for you to do this for years. You're a terrible person. A lot of people don't do that. A lot of people realize it's a very beautiful act of saying, look, I'm imperfect. And the person you say sorry, I'm imperfect too. I did make mistakes. Yeah, we all make mistakes. We're human beings. Let's love each other in spite of the mistakes. Just like those trees in the forest, no tree is perfect. If it was perfect, it would just, again, just be a false tree, not a natural tree. Each one of you have got your imperfections. That's why you're lovable. So we can forgive each other. And also just to expressing just how much we care for each other and respect each other, which is also a very, very beautiful thing. We know we have ordination ceremonies, you know, in our monastic tradition. We always like to invite the parents. And just one of our young men was ordained as an Anagarika last Wednesday. And his parents came up for the little ceremony. And it's wonderful just seeing the parents get involved. And when it becomes like a novice or a monk ordination, sometimes these are, you know, Australian parents, an Australian young man, and he bows to his parents and says, Mum, Dad, if there's anything which I have done which has irritated you or given you a hard time, I'm sorry. I respect and value you. Please forgive me. And I've seen that here and seen the mother and the father, who are not even Buddhists, just burst out crying. Because it's such a beautiful little ceremony to say forgiveness. Because it's part of the ordination ceremony, it's something which is always done at that time. But wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to do that now, if it's on Father's Day or Mother's Day? Just sit them down and even bow to them out of respect, out of love. And just say, Mum and Dad, me bowing to you doesn't mean that, you know, I think you're God. It just, I thank you for all the sacrifice and the hard work you've done. Yeah, you're not perfect, I'm not perfect. But I ask forgiveness, and Mum and Dad ask forgiveness of you back. It's a beautiful little ceremony, which, if we can do it while we're still alive, there's no regrets when we die. The biggest regret which people have, well, I think, when they die, is that all these opportunities which came to you, you never took them. Sometimes we're just so afraid and so scared just to take that one step of courage, to actually to believe in our heart and forget what other people are going to say about us. A lot of times we're afraid, I can't say that, people will criticize me, people will blame me, people will look down upon me. But that's something as a Buddhist monk which I've always gone against. Even just imagine wearing these robes in Australia for the last 28, 29 years. That takes a lot of guts. Going all over the world dressed like a girl. That's what people think sometimes. But every time he says, I don't care what people say or think of me, I'm just going to go and do it. Because you have that courage, you know, to live with that integrity, with that sincerity. This is what I think is right, this is what I'm going to do, to stand up. Or again, one of those things which keeps coming up because it's something which I almost blew, I almost failed, but I was strong enough to go for it, and that was the bhikkhuni ordination. You know, standing up for women so they can also have full ordination as well. Those are the things. If I didn't do that, that would be such a big regret which I would have for the rest of my life, even though there's consequences. Sometimes if you don't do what you believe in, you don't stand up and say, I don't care what the consequences are, this is what I have to do. Otherwise, it's always a regret in life. There's so many chances and opportunities have come up in your life so far, you haven't taken them. There are little chances, like just to change your job and do something you really love, but you know you're too scared to do. My advice is do it. Otherwise you regret it afterwards. Sometimes it's a chance of, you know, when you're a young man, young girl, going up to that person you like and just saying hello. How many of you have never done that and you've regretted it afterwards? It's really important to sort of not have that regret because you've been afraid. That's one of the reasons why that in Buddhism, in this place, as long as I'm the spiritual dictator, spiritual director, but spiritual dictator sometimes, you're all allowed to make mistakes. Give it a try. See what happens. Don't be afraid. Because that fear of making a mistake, that fear of falling on your face, that feeling of being ridiculed, that's what stops you. You know, experimenting, playing, and just trying out new things in life. And you regret that when you die. I never tried. I never gave it a go. Yeah, so you fail. Yeah, you make a fool of yourself. But I say when I make a fool of myself, I create so much happiness in the world. So many people laugh at me. So you're not afraid of making a fool. Because one of the things which I learned, again, these little sayings which you throw out, if you do make a fool of yourself, because you try something new and just give it a go, see what happens. And number one, you don't regret it because you tried. And if people do laugh, make sure that you laugh as well. Then the world never laughs at you. It only laughs with you. Yeah. Beautiful little saying. So when I do something stupid, I laugh as well. And that means no one ever laughs at me. They only laugh with me. So that means you're not so afraid of taking chances and taking risks and doing things which are a little bit abnormal, just because at the end of your life you'll think, oh, I wish I'd have done that. Fortunately, as Buddhists, it doesn't really matter. Buddhists don't have so many regrets because, you know, you get another chance. Now, poor other religions only get one life, but you guys, this is so fortunate. You know, you've got, it's like multiple entry visas into, you know, human life, instead of a single entry visa from other life. So you're very fortunate. So if you make a few mistakes or, you know, there's a few unfinished business, it doesn't matter. You can come back again and just get your list going for the next life as well. But it's good to do as much as you can in this life before you go. And that means that when you do die, you can die at peace and happy with no regrets. But the last little simile, again, it's an important one which I've said before, which needs to be reinforced. It's when you do die, when it's a time for you to go, go with the blessings of all the people who love you and care for you. Which is why that if you have a loved one, someone you really care for, who's on their deathbed, please give them permission to die. Because a lot of times, you know, if that's you about to die, you think the worst thing I could possibly do in life is to make these people who really care for me, to make them upset. And I know that if I die, it makes so many people upset. So it means you cling on to life. You struggle and you hurt. You're in big pain and agony. You're doing that because you don't want to hurt the people who love you by dying. And that is really unfair. So please, each one of you, whenever there's someone who's about to go, please, specifically, give them permission to die. Mum, I love you so much. I love you so much. I know you're hurting. You can go, you can die. I'll be fine. You have my blessing. You have my permission. That means so much to people. It means that I can die. My family, my loved ones, let me. There was a case of this one monk, and he was so sick for many years. He was in our monastery in UK. And it was that monk, Ajahn Sumedho, got the great insight. He'd been sick for years, really sick, never getting out of his bed, bedridden for 2 or 3 years. And one day he went up to this attic room in this house, which is a monastery in Sussex. He went up to the attic room and said to this man, who was an Oxford Rhodes Scholar, who was just wasting away, and he said, I've come up here on behalf of all the monks and nuns in this monastery, all the lay people who come and listen to you and care for you. I come on behalf of all of them to give you permission to die. Please don't try so hard to get better. It's okay to die. You have everyone's permission. And this Oxford scholar, who's a champion wrestler, he burst out crying. He wept. He wept and wept and wept and wept. Once he didn't have to try so hard to get better. He could just die. It was okay. And from that time on, that was about 30 years ago now. It was over 30 years ago, about 32 years ago. I think I can date it. From that time on, he started to get better. And he's still alive to this day. He sent me an email a couple of years ago. A brilliant story. He was trying so hard to get better, you know, for his friends. That was what was making him sick. The stress of trying to get better. So, but it doesn't work for everybody. Sometimes they die because... because it's their time to go. And they die at peace, knowing they've got the permission from all the people they love the most. What a beautiful thing that is. So that is, you know, deathbed without any regrets. And it can be a very beautiful time. But it also teaches us, if you want to die well, you know how to live well. So please take a bit more time in your life and appreciate the moment. It's not just, you know, taking a rest. If you appreciate the moment, appreciate the garden as it is, rest, relax in it. When you want something more, you can't appreciate what you already have. You appreciate your garden, and that's the start. Then you start appreciating the people you live with. You start appreciating yourself. Look, you know, it's amazing. You even start to appreciate the government. You do. It's not that bad. It could be worse. But this is the opening up to appreciate yourself, which is the biggest meaning of life, to be at peace with yourself. And then when you die, you have absolutely no regrets. Thank you for listening. So, does anyone want to ask a question? If you don't ask a question, you will regret it. Okay, while you're thinking about that, there's always questions from one from Dubai, one from Sri Lanka, one from Perth. Okay. Ajahn Brahm, I'm afraid that one of my deathbed regrets is that I never told my ex-husband how upset I was at him. What can I do to lessen my regret or anger? Okay. When you tell someone you're upset at them, remember the old sandwich method. First of all, before you tell your husband how upset you were with him, tell your husband how much you loved him and cared for him. Because there's more to your marriage than those things which you really get upset at. Tell your husband, put it in context. There's no human being alive who is that bad that they've never done really beautiful, good, kind, generous, compassionate things. Look at those in your husband first. Tell him how much you love him, how much you care for him, all the wonderful things you respect about him. Then tell him about what upsets you. And finish off with things which you would respect and care for him. That would change the whole conversation. Number one, you're being wise enough not just to see the two bad bricks in the wall. You're seeing the other bricks in the wall in that husband. You're getting a much, much wiser view. You are telling the faults in that husband which he needs to listen to and to hear. But it's being couched in such a way, you're not destroying the whole person that's your husband. You're showing respect for him, first of all, as all human beings should be respected, all human beings. Respecting them, but telling them what they need to hear, their faults, and finishing off with respect. Number one, you'll see a much better picture of your husband, and he will be able to listen to the faults and maybe even correct them. When I'm told off in this way by the monks, respect me first of all, tell me my faults, and then show they really respect me afterwards. Because I know they respect me, I take what they say seriously, and I try and do better. So if you want your husband to do better, so he never upsets you again, try that sandwich method. Then he will get better, and you won't need to sort of think that I don't need to say that. Another person from Sri Lanka. Dear, can I get that off? They've got a little message on here, I can't say it. Good. Dear Ajahn, I love music. It is something I find so relaxing and enjoyable. It is one addiction I can't possibly let go. Help, please. Oh, come on. There's so many other addictions which are much worse than music. So let go of all those other addictions first of all. If that's the only addiction you've got left, you're a pretty good person. So make sure you never get angry, you never say bad words, you keep all the other precepts, don't go around killing people or stealing or having lust of people you should never do. You don't, you know, that you don't break the sixth precept of spending too much on your credit card. You don't do all these other things. That's only a joke. That's not a sixth precept. don't know if you heard about that wife who spent so much on this credit card. Husband gave her plastic surgery for a birthday present. You know what plastic surgery means? Cutting up the credit cards. So I love music, that's okay. So go for music, and then you start changing from like Jimi Hendrix to something a bit softer, like sort of Beethoven, and then go to Brahms, and then go to Ajahn Brahm, and then go to silence and meditation. So you just wean yourself off your music. But that's not a bad thing. Lily, who lives in Perth, dear Ajahn, I'm in a position that I feel the system is exploiting the employees by pressuring us to work 64 hours every second week. How can I deal with this situation? Actually, that I'm in the same position as you. My employees make me work so hard, Mr. President. And I enjoy what I'm doing. Okay, they pressure you to work 64 hours of work, then change your job. There's other work to be done in Perth. This is not sort of a low. It's not sort of a city with low, with hard to get a job. So 64 hours every second week, that's a huge amount of work to be done. What's that? 17, that's about 9 hours a day. That's actually not so much, that's 7 days a week. No, you do need to have a bit of a rest. So if that's what you're doing, you're kidding yourself, and that's not a very good company which does that. You know, when I've been giving talks at business schools, I always mention this firm called Farrelly & Sons. You can look it up on the internet, Farrelly. Many years ago, it won a business award in UK. Because in 1 year, in 12 months, it trebled its turnover and doubled its profits. And they just used the most simple of techniques and strategies, which is why it stood out and won this great business award for innovative business policy. Trebled its turnover, doubled its profits. All they did was to ban overtime. No employee could take work home. No employee could work over the hours. When it's time for them to finish, right out, go home to your family. And they treble turnover, double profits. Obviously, you can think, why? Number one, if you work for such a company like that, you want to do the best for that company. So staff turnover went to zero. No one wanted to leave. Now, if you're working in a company like this, makes you work 64 hours a day, you want to get out, which means that you lose all those really key employees of your company. And every manager knows how hard it is to train new employees. I think it's usually about 6 months before they really get the hang of the job. They know the clients, the customers, the suppliers, and everybody else. And that's 6 months where you're losing a lot of income. So if you can keep your employees, your profits go up. Number two, to get your employees to be productive. Imagine what it's like, this person. They'll be really, really tired when they turn up for work. They'll be negative. Maybe because they hardly spend any time with their family. They have family problems with their kids and their partner because they never see each other. And when you have problems at home, you take them to work with you. That negativity, sometimes that means you get angry at the people you work with. It means you can't really focus when you're worried about the divorce or the kids getting into trouble with the police. This company, every employee could spend the evening and weekend with their family, which meant their kids did really well in their life. The husband and wife, being together, spending time together, there wasn't so much friction. So when they went to work on Monday morning, they were fresh. They didn't have so many family problems to take to work with them, which means they were far more productive. When the company was kind to them, they felt they should be kind back to their company. It's easy to work out why that was an incredibly smart business initiative. Caring for your employees meant they were more productive. They were kinder to the people they dealt with, which meant in 1 year, profits doubled, turnover trebled. It's a wonderful example. 64 hours a day. That's bad business practice. You're losing your key employees. They're probably not very productive when they work so long. You should send them home. So anyway, that's Buddhist business practice, Buddhist economics. They tried everything else and nothing works. Credit crunch, European debt. So I think if Wayne Swan is listening, this is how to run the Australian economy.